Good morning, Rip. Good morning, everybody on the council. It's a pleasure to be here today. When I was coming into Newport here, I noticed a long line of traffic leaving the hotel, and I wasn't quite sure what that was, but I figured it was probably SBRM on the agenda item. So I thought this is one of those riveting topics. But I think one important thing is one of the reasons it is sort of gets second-class citizenship is that, you know, we don't have a slogan. And I think the slogan should be ecosystem-based management starts here, because this is where you begin to understand all of the interactions among different fleets and their importance of this. So if I can, there we go. This one, all right, there we go. So the outline of today's presentation is to discuss the three-year report and the findings thus far. I'll give a little bit of background on the SBRM lawsuit update, talk about our report, which is, you know, a fairly extensive analysis of the last 3 years of data, and then finally to make some recommendations and considerations for changes to the SBRM. The lawsuit update, the Court of Appeals on July 19th. Okay, thanks. All right. Thanks. On July 19th, found that the agency had not established a lawful SBRM because it had too much discretion in terms of allocating observers when there were shortfalls of money. And so it went back to the U.S. District Court of Columbia, and on September 15th they ruled that the amendment is vacated and further ordered that the case is remanded to the National Fisheries Management Service for further proceedings consistent with the opinion of the Court of Appeals. Now, we're not quite sure who that is, but when we find them, we're going to tell them there's a lot of work to do. So, next slide. So, under the original vacated three-year SBRM, there's a report required, which is to review available data and prepare a report assessing the effectiveness of the program. So we'll go back a couple. There we go. Next one and next one. I'll try to. So just for the sake of clarification, when we refer to an SBRM year, it's a matter of convenience, much like a fishing year. It starts on a date described here. So the 2009 report that we're referring to reflects data from 2007 through June of 2008, and then going so on and so forth to the 2011 year reflects July 2009 through June 2010. So those are the years where we use for planning, and those are the years in which we are evaluating the data. So they don't correspond to a fishing year. They don't correspond to a calendar year. They correspond to a year in which the fishing, the observers are allocated. So next slide. So the first report was already published. It was in the Center reference document. It provides background on the amendment, the summary of the observer coverage levels that were obtained, a summary of the encounter rates and estimates of, and probably item 5 is the most important one. It has the estimate of total discards associated with each fleet and species. So next slide gives you kind of a scorecard of the number of fleets that were incorporated into consideration for the SBRM on an annual basis, the number of fleets with pilot coverage. One important thing is that there are now 52 fleets under consideration for 52 fleets under consideration for allocating discards. The estimated baseline sea days in order to achieve the target level of 30% coefficient of variation of discards represents something like 52,000 days for 2011. When you filter those down by taking out of consideration the imprecisely measured small quantities, you end up with target levels of what we call standard sea days of about 15 to 19,000 days at sea. In any given year, we typically fall short of that that total amount which is available. That's on the order of about 13,000 or 14,000 days in 2011. And there are shortfalls that arise not only due to the total magnitude of the observer coverage that can be funded, but also due to constraints on funding which arise from congressional appropriations and the intent of Congress to direct much or most of the fishery allocation observer coverage to New England fleets. Now, this part of the talk plays much better here than down in the Mid-Atlantic. New England has been the beneficiary of most of the coverage. So the next slide. So as part of this Fishery Management Action Team, or FMAT, we've had a number of monthly meetings. They consist of NERO staff, the staff from the center, the Mid-Atlantic Fishery Management Council, New England Fishery Management Council, and Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission. Next slide. The main contents of this document, and I'll give you a few points, high points, if you want to call them that, in terms of summarizing the discard reasons, which is, I think, you know, a pretty good indication of not only the scope for improvement, but also the implications for management actions. How well we've done in terms of meeting the performance measure, the metric of 30% CV, review of the methodology, and an interest issue of major concern is our potential sources of bias and analysis of the accuracy, and I'll talk about that. And then finally, some of the implications for management and recommendations. So on the next slide, the discard reasons. It's, you know, important to distinguish between economic versus regulatory, and there are a lot of reasons. Many of them are self-declared by the fishermen on the vessels, but they fall into a number of general categories, which we've summarized as no market, poor quality, and then various forms of regulatory discards, where explicit regulatory discards such as size, quota, or some other constraint imposed by regulation. So the next slide gives kind of a quick summary of the discard reasons, and roughly about 80% of the total discards are attributed to no market, and that fraction was consistent across years, 83, 80, and 80% in SBRM years. And then the regulations, the regulatory effect, that is through quota or size limits, typically is on the order of 15 to 16%. So poor quality and other ones are way behind in terms of the fraction. Now, there is some ambiguity in terms of no market conditions, and many of them, for example, and large fraction of the total discards are associated with skates, and so there the issue of it is perhaps regulatory landings, but also no market for the magnitude of volume of fish that could be brought in. Next slide. In terms of evaluating this standard, we have a number of categories, whether or not they were in some instances we eliminated those fleets and species mixtures that were small quantities, imprecisely measured, and you know, really focus in on the core set of fishing behavior and also discarding, such that we incorporate the important quantities, that is 95% of the total, as opposed to these marginal fractions here. The next slide. This is an interesting one. So this is a kind of a composite scorecard over the 3 years under consideration, and it gives for both New England and the Mid-Atlantic regions the fraction of discards. A fraction of fleets. Each element in there represents the number of fleets associated with this. that have coefficients of variation less than 30% than those with greater than 30%. Overall, there's roughly 89 fleets that have met the standard, whereas roughly 41 have not met the standard. And in not meeting the standard, typically it's fairly small fraction that exceed that coefficient of variation target. The coefficient of variation target is a standard that has been developed, but it's a percentage. It wasn't based on any hard estimates other than it's a desirable goal reflective of a statistical precision that can allow you to make some inferences about differences between different quantities. So next slide. So in order to conduct the SVRM, the important thing is that you're able to use the information in a given year and use it as a measure of projecting the magnitude of discard coverage that you need in the following year. In order to do that, you need to have some measure of knowing that the stability, the variance that you measure in one year carries over to the next, and so therefore you're allocating. So if it was to change dramatically between 2 years, it would mean you would be misallocating resources if, say, management measures were to change dramatically. For groundfish, of course, that resonates immediately because there were massive changes in terms of how the fleet or how groundfish were managed. So it does have very important implications for the utility of this approach going into the future. So on the next slide, I'll give a couple examples here where I'm looking at the estimate of variance. Each one of those points on the graph reflect a particular fleet. And and I'm doing a year-to-year comparison there. So simply looking at how well does the 2009 relate to 2011 or the 2009 relate to 2010. The take-home message is that in general they're fairly tightly correlated. That there is some predictability across years, and that at least so far. We have seen that you can use at least the year of the previous year as a basis for allocating resources in the next year. The next slide shows the coefficient of variation, a similar comparison here. This is the coefficient of variation is the relative variance divided by the average. So, again, when you have high imprecision or high CVs in 1 year, you tend to have them in the next year for the same fleet and vice versa. So that means when you're trying to reduce your overall variability or coefficient of variation, you allocate more to those that have the highest CV as opposed to the opposite. The next slide looks at measures of bias. Bias is an important consideration from sort of an epistemological standpoint. You have to it's how do you know what you think you know, and if you believe that you can put an observer on a boat and actually measure behavior that is representative of the fleet, then it's a knowable process. If you believe that you cannot reliably observe fisherman behavior by putting a person on the boat, then it's an unknowable process. And the only solution to that is to put observers on all the boats. So, this is a very important point in terms of bias. And there are no direct measures of bias that you can have that are unequivocal. Most of them are sort of weak forms of inference. That is, you can observe the quantity landed for observed boats that have observers on board and those that do not have observers on board. And that becomes a measure of whether there's some bias in it, but it's a very difficult principle, and there's a lot of sophisticated statistical approaches that are used by things like credit card companies to figure out whether or not the husband or the wife is at the supermarket with the credit card. They can tell by the mix of products. The Slim Jims and Cheetos are probably from the husband, and the granola and the yogurt is from the wife. So, those kinds of things apply directly to this type of observed and unobserved behavior. But the But one of the things you can do in terms of this is to compare the average pounds kept by the species group for the observed and non-observed components. The second is to compare differences in averages, and then the third is to compare measures of trip duration. That is, do they just go around the buoy when they have an observer on board and come back to port, or do they actually take a trip? Next slide. Okay, so this is kind of a similar concept here. We're looking at trips that discarded fluke, scup, and sea bass, looking at the kept pounds on the unobserved trips versus the kept pounds on the one's observed and the other's unobserved. I don't know who prepared these slides. It's probably me. The label is wrong on there. And it occurs in both this one and the next. But the correlation between the two is designed to illustrate that in terms of average pounds kept on a fleet across years, and the three ellipses correspond to multiple years, there is, in fact, a reasonably strong relationship between average catches. Now, the scatters off to the side where, observed catches is less than the unobserved average catch is a problem. I was trying to make these things bigger so you could actually see the label, the axes, so I did mess that up. Okay, next slide is for large mesh groundfish. Here you see a much tighter relationship reflective largely of the increased coverage that occurs for large mesh groundfish. And in general, there's not a lot of measurable forms of bias in terms of total observed catch and the observed and unobserved trips. The next slide is a series of just sort of looking at the differences between the fleets. So this is a sampling distribution of the differences between the observed and unobserved kept pounds. And so you take a fleet average for observed and unobserved, look at the difference, and then see that. So you like to see that thing symmetric and about zero, and it typically is very highly skewed centrally or I guess leptokurtotic if you're following this kind of stuff. But it's very very highly concentrated around zero, as you would expect. Same thing occurs in the next slide for large mesh groundfish. However, there are a number of instances in which the observed average kept pounds exceeds. That is, that little tail on the left is reflective of that, and most likely that is indicative of a preponderance of trips during this period, which were allocated to the U.S., Canada, and special access programs, which tended to be on Georges Bank and larger vessels within a given fleet component. Next slide. This is the trip duration. I've got the slide correctly labeled here in terms of unobserved and observed trips. And in this case, there's no strong indication of shorter trips on the unobserved versus the observed. So again, these are all weak measures of inference. They're not conclusive or definitive. That there are almost certainly measures of bias that occur when the observer is on board. Whether or not they're relevant to the bottom line for the fleet or measuring the average, I guess, is the key question. And we're trying to at least explore this and we'll be summarizing this as part of our overall report. Next slide. So, again, one of the things I think fishermen often bring up is, well, so what's in it for me? Why is it important to understand the discarding? Well, I mean, for one, the precision of the discard estimates generally reflects the overall uncertainty of the stock assessment. And in the Mid-Atlantic, for example, that uncertainty is manifest as in a tiering system that puts the species into various bins. The more uncertain you are, the worse the grade you get. We've been getting mostly Cs on our, they got three tiers. We've been getting level three, which is like a C on most of our assessments. So the more uncertain the estimates are, the more likely you are to have a larger buffer associated with catches. And in general, the larger the uncertainty in the assessment, the greater the buffer between the overfishing limit and the acceptable biological catch. These really impede the council's overall ability to achieve optimum yield. And finally, the imprecise estimates of discards reduce the ability of managers to determine whether management measures that are intended to reduce discard and promote more efficient use of the resource are actually working. For example, estimates on the rule trawl rely not only on monitoring of the rule trawl vessels, but also accurate reporting by fishermen of vessels of that particular piece of gear being used on the vessel. So we can make inferences about the total if we can have better inferences about what is actually being used. So it ties together very tightly with the efficacy of management measures and also the ability to achieve optimum yield. Recent increases in both skates and spiny dogfish are keenly tied to the estimates of discards and also the precision of those estimates. Next slide. One of the things that became evident that the original SBRM was not perfect, and so that it was in need of some major revisions. So we have tried to make those make some recommendations for that. One of them is this so-called unlikely filter, which is sort of a pre-specified consideration of unlikely occurrences, such as there are scallops taken in gillnets, but that's not really an important factor, and we have a lot of data to show that that's not an important factor now. So rather than just pre-specify it as unlikely, we can empirically measure that. A nuance to be sure, but an important one. We need to have more review of pilot coverage. There are recommendations for pilot coverage each year, and you generally have to build up some information base before you can accurately allocate observer coverage. We want to try to improve the estimates for turtles, particularly in the scallop fleet, and use some of the more model-based estimators for not only improving the precision but also increasing the accuracy of those. And then finally, some consideration of additional species. There are some a variety of radioactive species, river herring, for example, that could benefit by explicit consideration in terms of observer coverage. And that, of course, is ultimately a management decision in terms of how that coverage is allocated. But one of the things that is clear in terms of you can go to the next one there. I'm blabbing enough. One of the things that is clear is that all of these fleets are tied together, that explicit decisions to consider a particular species have implications for others. So the future SBRM, whatever format it takes, will require some flexibility in modifying fleet coverage rates, especially the ability to add and delete fleets. If we read this as it was actually written, the changes that we made in terms of increasing numbers of fleets would be illegal, so to speak, because it was added without council amendment. Now, if we need council amendment or framework action every time a fleet pops up, then it would make this thing hopelessly lame and way behind in terms of timeliness. So we want to seek to have that as part of the next amendment. So a simple example would be the rule trawl. You know, if we couldn't have responded to that that major change in fleet behavior without having a particular authorization through a framework action by both councils in order to achieve that. The annual discard report, which is one of the largest and least read documents in council history, has a lot of discard rates. But you know, it's clear from council request and fleet that it's important to have discard totals as part of this thing, so that you can actually keep a scorecard. There's a perceived need to have this all synchronized, such that that the information that that comes out of the SBRM process or the summary is synchronized with assessments, is synchronized with fishing years, is synchronized with a fiscal year, and so forth. All of that's basically impossible. There are six different fishing years across both councils. So in order to synchronize those with any one of those would mean this would be simply a year-round process, and you'd have me up here every month, which would not be good. Okay, synchronization of there are major constraints on funding, and that of course is a major concern, and one that is being addressed in various ways. And I'll let you know. I think we have attempted to maintain consistency with our perception of congressional intent in terms of funding this. So that is basically how it's gone thus far. How we finesse this in the future, how this actually plays out, I guess, is the open question. Next slide. Some overarching issues. This is, you know, just that the first step in monitoring the efficacy of fisheries management is a comprehensive approach for monitoring discards, and that's you know, if we do the slogan, you know, it's ecosystem based management starts here. So you know, when we talk about coefficients of variation, it's important to say 30% of what. And that 30% of what is important because it's thrown around kind of loosely, you know, the current use of it in terms of SBRM is for 30% of the aggregate species mix or set of stocks within a fishery management plan. It's not Gulf of Maine haddock. It's not fluke specifically. It's fluke, scup, and sea bass. It's the multi-species groundfish complex. It's squid, mackerel, and butterfish as an aggregate. So that's how it's currently defined. If we want to make it 30% of Gulf of Maine cod, then it requires a major change and also a major increase, because the more specific you try to make your level of inference to smaller and smaller subunits, the higher the level of coverage that's required in order to achieve that. There's always going to be trade-offs. Anytime we have an increased focus on one species over another, it's going to come at the expense of something else. We can either handle them objectively or not, but someone's going to pay for increased coverage. And then finally, the councils are interlinked on this, as well as with the ASMFC. And it's important to define, you know, what discards are relative to other sources of mortality. And this is my last slide. Next one. So one of the things we should do is have provisions for adding or deleting fleets as the needs arise. We want to is it important or is it necessary to consider other species groups? Do we need 30% on each species, each stock, each sector, each gear within sector, all of those things in terms of reducing or the coefficient of variation, increasing the precision, costs money. So every step of the way requires increased cost associated with that. You know, is that information worth it is really the key management issue. You know, handling a protected species is important. You know, should we consider the discard rate of turtles with respect to the total stock size? And do we apply the same standards in terms of that aspect of discard monitoring? Or do they warrant or merit, you know, special consideration. Those are policy decisions. Those aren't matters of science. And then finally, this is a moving target. It's not possible to, in any given year, know in advance what the overall level of coverage is likely to be. So, the whole process needs to be very adaptable. We've tried throughout the last 3 years to make the council aware of what the changing needs are, the changing perceptions of observer coverage, and then bring that to the council's attention, give them opportunity to comment on the process. So, and that will remain a challenge, I suspect, in the current fiscal environment. So that's all I have, and happy to answer any questions if I can. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Rago, for another riveting presentation. Dr. Pierce.
Thank you, Paul. Could you explain how the presentation you have just given relates to the coverage that would be required for all the different sectors to get estimates of bycatch within the sectors?
Sure. The standard, it gets back to the 30% of what. When we talk about observer coverage, requesting or mandates a finer scale level of inference that is related to smaller quantities. So it's stock within sector, and then within sector and stock, there's a gear aspect of that. So we're trying to make finer and finer inferences about the magnitude of removals associated with stocks within sectors. So in order to achieve that standard, there's typically a need for a higher level of coverage. You don't want to be subject to the average condition for the fleet as a whole. There are differences among sectors, and those, in order to make inferences about those differences among sectors, it's necessary to have an increased level of coverage associated with that. Process is also mandated, another aspect of the coverage level for sectors is that SBRM was not designed to provide real-time inferences about total catch. It's an after-the-fact target so the mandated coverage or the need to monitor sectors on a real-time basis will typically require a frequency of observation of information coming in that is much greater than you would need if you simply had to do it on an annual basis. So, and then I guess the final difference is more of a methodological one associated with the statistical estimator that's used. We do a little bit more stratification by quarter when we do the SBRM estimates. On a real-time basis, it's very difficult to infer that, so we use a cumulative method, which averages out over the course of a fishing season. So it provides a measure, so sort of like dollar cost averaging and stocks and things like that. But it is looking at the average rate cumulatively over time. So those are the major differences.
Is the center, you and your staff, are you looking at discrete information by sector to determine, using the 30% CV, the amount of ATSI coverage within each sector that's required to get that 30% CV?
Yes. The monitoring process for the sector coverage is handled by the regional office, and Michael Lanning has been the key analyst involved with that process. At the aggregate level, looking at the 30% CV as mandated by SBRM, that is on the aggregate mix of groundfish, we have incredibly precise estimates, like 3-4%. As you start to split it up in terms of sectors, level of coverage diminishes, but at the stock level, I think most of the, if I remember his information correctly, most of the stocks have overall coefficients of variation less than 30%. Now, at the sector level, you start to find things start to drop off. Not all of the sectors and not all the stocks within sectors have that target CV. But at the level where it matters in terms of the resource that's ultimately available for everybody to share, it does seem to be making a pretty good overall progress on it. Whether it's oversampling or not, ultimately comes down to a policy decision in terms of what's important. How much do you need precision on these quantities in order to ensure that you don't overfish, and whether that's at the sector level or at the stock level or at the stock within sector level is ultimately a policy decision. Thank you.
Jim Odlin.
Yes, if we were, for instance, to eliminate regulatory discards, would you be able to have less observer coverage and still maintain your 30% CV?
I think as a general rule, yes. Can be kind of a paradox that occurs in that, rare quantities become more difficult to monitor, and that is why, for example, protected species and marine mammal coverage rates tend to be fairly high, because these are intrinsically rarer events than fish. So you could run into sort of a problem oh my God, someone threw a cod overboard kind of situation, where that would be a rare event. In order to precisely measure that, you'd have to do it overall. But I think the process that we've developed for inclusively treating all sources of mortality and incorporating the magnitude of that occurs from all sources, it would filter out those things. So I'm getting to a long way of answering, yes, it would improve it. Thank you. Thanks.
Dave Gaisel.
I had a couple questions, Paul. You mentioned the increase in dartfish and skates is changing things, and I agree with you. I mean, it's driving this so-called, we call it the infamous K-all, where I'm getting whacked for hundreds of pounds of cod that I never killed because I never caught them, because I catch a lot of dogfish. And I really urge you to reexamine that. It's bad enough that we, have this occurring, but now that we're paying for those fish to throw them over and they don't exist, it really hurts. Plus, I think it's driving stock assessments. I mean, if we're assuming that you threw over, say, 7,000 pounds of cod, and you really only threw over 700, that's on the order of 6,000 pounds of fish that never existed that the stock assessment assumed do exist. So that would be number one. The second one is, and you mentioned this, my sector, which is 12, had the highest level of observer coverage, 46.5%. According to the report we received, there are 840 strata in my sector, and we reached the CV of 30% was only met in 51% of the strata, despite 46.5% coverage. And in order to meet the CV of 30% in all the strata, we'd need 91% coverage. That seems unrealistic to me. So my question is, do we need less strata? Do we need a bigger CV? If we're going to essentially require 100% coverage in a sector that had a discard rate of 7,500 pounds of fish for the year, and according to my sector manager, you would have come up with 7,500 pounds whether you had 15% coverage or 50% coverage. He can demonstrate that. you know, what are we getting for all this extra coverage, basically? And do we need it?
Well, I think you've made my point on the need. You know, is there a need to know very precise estimates of discard totals at the sector level per se? It's sort of like, you know, if you're doing a poll of a voting in terms of a community, you can sample probably 1,000 individuals or some small number of people and get a pretty good estimate of who's going to win an election. If you want to know what every household is going to do and try to make a prediction that or a block of houses together, then, of course, you need much higher levels of coverage. In this case, you're correct. The 91% coverage rate applies to making that inference about 30% CV for every single quantity, every single strata, every single cell that's, you know, the combination. I think there's 830 of them, which reflect sector times stock times gear mixture. So if you want to make that level of inference about it, then the coverage rates will be extraordinarily high. You know, from a marketing standpoint, no one's going to pay a premium price for a product that is caught with a CV of 30% or less. You know, you pay a premium for a stock that is well managed in aggregate and, you know, has a reliable supply chain overall. So that's sort of the, I think makes an, you know, you make an important point about the need to have some realism. And I think the coverage rate that came out of the Groundfish Committee, which recommended something on the order of 25% coverage, was in fact a kind of a balance between that which sort of falls off the table in terms of not being covered with the level of not having precise quantities of those precise estimates of those small quantities, you know, and in aggregate, you get a pretty good estimate of the overall pattern of removals.
Okay, and my last question. First, I'll make a comment about voting in New Hampshire at the moment. If you call me, you get hung up on. You're not going to find out how I vote. It's none of your damn business.
And non-response is a major problem in all statistical surveys.
That's right, and that's why, and it's getting worse because we're sick of being polled. But my last comment is on the lawsuit aspect of this. Is the court mandating a level of coverage, or have they remanded it to you to set a level of coverage, and you can set whatever level you deem appropriate?
I'm going to defer to a higher power.
Are you referring to me? I appreciate that. No, the court did not look at or rule on the scientific underpinnings of the SBRM, that is, whether 30% CV was sufficient or any of the related issues there. The court only looked at, the court only ruled on the this prioritization process, that if external factors, such most likely budget constraints, don't allow sufficient observer coverage to meet the 30% CV level, then it reverts to NIMS to, with consultation with the council, to prioritize how they're going to deploy observers at a level that is less, at least for some segments of the fishery, that's less than 30%, or that is doesn't meet the 30% CV. It would be greater than 30% CV. So the court left that untouched and only said that the SBRM was flawed because of the prioritization process was too vague. It wasn't clear enough when the trigger would be pulled to resort to the prioritization process. So the court did not even suggest that you had to meet the 30% CV. It was just concerned that the trigger, when you did not meet it, was not sufficient. So the way we interpreted the decision you can still have an SBRM that may not meet the 30% CV in all cases, but it needs to be a clearer, more defined methodology for what happens when there isn't sufficient funding, or how you determine there isn't sufficient funding for meeting the 30% CV minimum criteria.
Okay, I think I got that. But for example, if you set the CV at 40% and then you set a, you put in a prior, to, ooh, I hate that word. Yeah, a scheme to
we don't,
you
like
know,
scheme.
Do something when you didn't have enough money to meet that standard, that would, it sounds like that would satisfy the court, right? I mean, what if I understand what you're saying, Gene, is that you have to come up with a way to determine how you're going to move around your limited funding in the event that funding limits your ability to cover everything.
Well, I'm not sure if that's the way I would term it. I mean, I think right now the record supports 30% CV as a sort of a worldwide standard that is accepted for these kinds of estimates of bycatch discards and so forth. So I don't know if we can get away from the 30% CV standard. We just have to either take away any prioritization process or define it in a more explicit way that it's predictable and clear and not discretionary for the agency in deciding how to redeploy in the absence of full funding to meet the 30% CV.
Okay, I think I got it now. Between the two of them, I'm starting to understand what the problem is and where we have to go to fix it. Thank you.
I have Mary Beth and Jim Odlin, then I'm going to go to the public for any comments. Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you for the presentation. I actually think I understood most of it. I was someone who did look at the first annual report, the one that you think nobody was reading. But
it's one.
I spent a bit of time with the first one, and then I never did go back to the others, pretty much because what I've been searching for is some kind of plain text description of what the outcome of the work has been. And so I was looking to the review, excuse me, to do that. And part two that you're giving us the sort of summary of here, it's not yet available. Is that correct, Paul?
It's not currently done. It's in progress. We're almost there, so to speak, but it's not out the door yet. So.
Yeah, so I was looking at part one, and I can't really scan through the 300 pages that quickly, but, I think you felt the need from the council to have some kind of plain text descriptions. And do you see that mostly available in this report and in part two, or if we were to be going down a certain road to get there, which place should we be looking?
I think in the long term, having a shorter summary annual report with discard totals in it will be the most informative and kind of comprehensible kind of outcome as part of this process. The way the language was written originally, it did prescribe inferences or request information about discard rates on a very fine scale, such as stock area estimates. And so, ultimately, at the end of the day, you don't have enough coverage rates to make those kind of really fine scale inferences. So but even just to tabulate that information is very difficult. What I'd like to do is to sort of put this online and have it in a way that could be searchable, such that you could reduce things in terms of, okay, if you want to reduce it to a certain level, then look at that broad scale basis, or if you need to know fine scale information, you could do it that way. You do get into confidentiality issues if you partition it too finely, so But in terms of the plain language summary, we'll try to work on that. It's very difficult for us to do things like that, but it is something we're trying. I mean, there is a 3-page report that comes out that summarizes the observer allocation coverage rate, and typically what we get on that is that I don't see enough information here, so you know we're always balancing those two.
Jim.
Paul, I'm trying to get my arms around the next steps for the council and to address the very point that Dave was bringing up about he'd need 90% to get the 91% coverage to get a CV in their sector. It would seem to me that the council needs to deal with a policy that may refocus the stratification needs back to the fisheries as a whole and away from the small stratification that we have found ourselves in. And we can do that in a couple of ways, minimize regulatory discards and go back to looking at a bigger picture. And I realize I'm not trying to get you to comment on policy, but I just want to make sure I'm understanding that that is something that we could undertake and would take policy change on the council. And then the council now, after that statement, would have to figure out how to accomplish that policy change if they so choose.
I think that's exactly right. It's a policy decision about what quantity you want to make inferences about, and what is most important for the management of the resource. So that spans everything from ensuring that the stock is at a size that produces a lot of fish, to fairness issues within and between sectors as well. So that's sort of the spectrum of consideration that would ultimately define where you come in with a policy on that.
I'm going to go to the public. Are there any questions? Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ron Smolowitz, Fisheries Survival Fund. Some questions for Paul. I told him I canceled my subscription to the Boston Globe, so I depend on the performance review to start my wood stove. It's lasted all winter. The number of fleets meeting the CV standard by species group, I don't quite understand the table. In 2011, you said there were 52 fleets.
Right.
How many of those were scallop fleets, and how were they defined?
Okay. The slide you're referring to is, I think, number 13. There we go, the blue and white one. This is a composite three-year slide, which, you know, so there are, you know, on an annual basis, there were 50... roughly 50 fleets per year that were considered. Some of those fell out because there was nothing in those fleets that was met the bar in terms of having a significant contribution to the total. The Scottish seine, for example, doesn't do much of anything because it doesn't exist anymore. It's not being used, but this is a composite three-year scorecard. So it represents over that period of time. There were three sea scallop instances where the information met the standard. This does not include turtles. So on this, so that's why there are three that were below the things, had 30% CV or less. The turtle one was not met in some instances.
Okay, but we have the cells, right? There's like 1,500 cells or some large amount of cells, so that
yes.
Each fleet has. So for a bycatch of yellowtail on George's Bank, there's one scallop fleet that fishes George's Bank, one cell, or is it multiple cells for yellowtail? And isn't it yellowtail that has the CV? So it's the species?
No, this scorecard is with respect to the mixture of all groundfish stocks. It's at a different level of resolution than we're doing with monitoring of yellowtail and the sea scallop dredge fleets, or haddock in the midwater trawls. Those are inferences and estimates that are apart from this particular summary here. This is looking at the aggregate mix of all groundfish as one cell within each of the, I think there are 10 scallop fleets identified. They range from the general category and limited access, open area, closed area, New England and Mid-Atlantic ports of departure. So that set of combinations define what we use in terms of defining a fleet in this instance.
Okay. So if this covers an aggregate of 3 years, that means each year the scallop fleet met its CV for multi-species?
Most likely. This doesn't have the species group identified. The reason there's only three in there is because the scallop fleet as a whole is very clean and does not constitute a huge impact on a proportional basis in terms of the removals of the other groundfish or other species, skates or dogfish or other things. So this will hopefully all be detailed in the report that's associated with this extracted table.
Okay, so my last question then, given that background, is that in George's Bank, the when we go to readdress the SBRM through an amendment, we're going to pick an observer coverage for each fleet. And so for the scallop fleet on George's Bank, the number of observers is going to be driven by the species that's probably the lowest bycatch rate that doesn't make the filter.
Or the species group. Yeah, it depends on how it's defined. So that will be a policy call and should be nested within this omnibus amendment. But the landscape is changing quite dramatically in terms of the inquiring minds want to know, you know, what is the I don't mean that flippantly, but I mean it, you know, you want to know about river herring, you want to know about sturgeon, you want to know a striped bass. You know, all of those things are not currently a basis for observer allocation. If that becomes a need, or if that is what we're trying to achieve with the overall aggregate allocation process, then that's something that we can analyze, but it's not currently part of the process.
Thank you. There's a lot of work here, I could see.
Gene. Yeah, just to clarify, and Paul, help me out if I step into this too far without sufficient information. But sort of in response to David and Jimmy's questions, you know, the agency's already decided that it's not going to impose a 90% CV requirement at all strata for various sectors. That was the presentation at the groundfish meeting by Dr. Lanning, which just, and it's a letter, and it's been, and the conclusion of that presentation has been included in a letter to the sectors already, that the sectors are looking at on balancing all of the needs for management purposes at a total of 25% coverage at most on sector vessels. So the agency has decided it isn't going to have to apply this extremely high level of coverage for the small gain that it gets for some of these smaller fleets and sectors and so forth. So just to make sure that the council is aware that that decision that policy has already been adopted and communicated to sectors.
Thank you. Gibb?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gibb Brogan with Oceana, and I'll admit that I've read every one of the annual reports. I'm ashamed to say, or proud to say, depending on the day, but I have read them all. And thank you for the presentation. This was really interesting. I've got a question. Your analysis of bias, and I'm trying to reconcile the SBRM years and calendar years and fishing years. It only covers, by my math, 2 months of the sector program. Is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
So none of the analysis of bias covers the sector program.
That's correct.
Okay. So that's one of the unanswered questions about going forward with the sector program is whether there's bias. So that's wanted to clear that one up. The other question is going forward on this as far as the agency's plan. Now that this has been remanded back to the agency to work on this, is this going to be an amendment before the council? Or is this going to be a secretarial amendment? Is there any information there? I saw the number of, and this leads to the suggestions that were in your presentation. A lot of those are things that we've been asking for quite a while, and they're great, great suggestions. But we're just wondering how we're going to move forward on this.
Pat?
Yeah, it's an amendment that will come before the council, so it's a council amendment. But our staff are largely taking the lead on preparing the amendment to provide the staff support needed to get it done.
Okay. So will there be a committee and a PDT, or has that not been hammered out yet?
There will need to be an FMAT. And so it will involve council staff. Just we'll do the lead and take the lead on preparing the documents.
Okay. If I could just make the request, during the last SBRM process, the FMAT process was closed, and it didn't allow the public to understand what was going on, and all the council and the stakeholders got to see were the periodic updates. And I think that contributed to a misunderstanding or a lack of understanding of how the SBRM works, the nuts and bolts of this really complex beast. And if those meetings could be more transparent, I think it would improve the process significantly for everybody that's involved. My one last question is on Gene's last comment about sector coverage for 2012. I didn't know that had been announced. The announcement about the 25% observer coverage was back when we were still looking at industry funding for 2012. And then the announcement came from Silver Spring that the agency will be paying for this. Has it been firmly established that the 25% coverage level is going to be what's used in 2012?
Yes. That didn't change with the announcement on the funding. The 25% was derived based on what we determined to be necessary. And unlike last year, where the levels were set more based on the funding, we looked instead, based on the information we had from last year, at what the appropriate level should be, and then determined how much funding we'd need to fund that.
Okay. And a follow-up on that is the Amendment 16 requires the agency to set the funding level and also to consider accuracy and accurate monitoring of the fishery administration at the sector level. Has that analysis been done to support the 25% number, or is Dr. Lanning's analysis the beginning and the end on this one?
I believe that the analysis that he conducted was the analysis that determined that the 25% coverage rate would be adequate to achieve the 30% CV.
But not look at the further clause of that requires a consideration of accuracy. His presentation specifically put in the assumption of random sampling, and I was just wondering, he had mentioned that there was further analysis that was ongoing either at the Science Center or at the regional office, that it may be going on and would further support this, but
help, Paul?
The issue of accuracy is one that we have not yet looked at in terms of the full year of of observer coverage. That will be part of the information that's provided to the council. We'll be looking at the overall precision of the estimates for the 2012 SBRM year. That information will be coming to the predicted observer coverage levels will be coming to the council sometime in winter here, January, February. The larger issue of whether or not we're getting an unbiased estimate on sector vessels is one to be determined. You know that you need a little bit more information in order to make that aspect. As I said, the landscape is changing. You know, everything we've seen thus far suggests that you're getting relatively unbiased estimates. Hopefully that continues with the further analysis of it. But in any event, it's going to be an issue of weak inference because you're only going to be able to look at the pattern of landings for the observed versus the unobserved trips. So, you know, if you have caught haddock and yellowtail caught on the observed trip and discarded, but the unobserved trip comes in only with haddock, you have an inferential problem. I mean, how do you make some inferences about the cod and yellowtail that might have been discarded or caught on that trip, or was this just simply an instance where the trip was in fact clean, and you know, there weren't any you know, they were using the rule trawl or some other separator trawl or something like that that was working. So it's a very tricky and by that I mean it's you only have a ability to weakly infer whether or not you have a bias occurring. You don't have forensic evidence of bias.
But our concern on that is different than the SBRM and the goal of looking at it fleet-wide. The monitoring for sectors is much different. It's quota monitoring, it's enforcement, and keeping each sector under its ACE allocation, which is a much different process. So having the true measure of what's happening in each of these sectors, I think, is a different question and a different issue. So when we're looking at the stratification of the sampling, it's a much different process to do quota monitoring. So, great. Thank you very much.
Drew, and then I'm going to bring it back to the council for one more question, and we'll break for lunch.
Thank you. Quickly, I just want to back up Gibbs' comments on the need for this process to be open to the public and to have public buy-in to what's happening. I think one of the real problems with how things were done last time was it was closed. It's a complicated issue, and it was very hard for people to pick up from the brief presentations that were given on it exactly what was going on. And I think it was very hard for the council, frankly, to understand exactly what they were voting on. So I think you should do everything we should do everything we can to avoid that scenario this time around and have a much more open process and public buy-in to how this the SBRM works. Thank you.
Tom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think there have been some comments about what I think is two essentially different scales of information. We're talking about SBRM, which was designed and has been implemented and is valuable at the fishery scale, but the council made a decision through sector management to manage at the sector scale. I think we get sort of wrapped up when we present ourselves the false choice of simply increasing or decreasing coverage rates under a system that was designed to do something else. I think Jim mentioned it earlier on. I think we should be starting to think about developing tools to allow us to achieve some of the objectives, the monitoring objectives in sector management, without, you know, some of the associated costs. One thing I did want to point out in the presentation that I would definitely appreciate seeing is at least the beginning of a discussion of the costs of not having monitoring. I think, you know, we talk about, and I'm certainly sensitive to and want to reduce the costs of a monitoring program, but there are very real costs of not having high-resolution, timely information. We've seen it this year where in Framework 47 we almost closed off unnecessarily tracks at bottom to a fleet for a bycatch problem that actually didn't exist. We need more information, and there are real costs to the fishery in terms of optimum yield when we don't have this kind of information. And hopefully as we develop these tools, you know, we can keep that in mind.
Did you want to comment on that? Okay.
Are we done? I just want one quick comment. I just want to acknowledge, you know, this the work here. I want to acknowledge particularly my colleagues, Susan Wigley and Jessica Blaylock, you know, very deeply and heavily involved in all of this stuff, and as well as to thank Amy Van Atten and all the observers and most especially the fishermen that take them out and bring them back. You know this is a huge amount of work that is involved in terms of doing all this analysis here. So again, just a thank you.
And thank you for the presentation and all the work that you do on it. We will break for lunch. I'm going to try and squeeze us a little bit, 1:40, so we can try and get back on track.